Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into the main story and issue in the news. We'll begin with the major foreign policy speech the president gave at West Point, where he outlined a new U.S. foreign policy based on collective action with allies, at the same time castigating his opponents in Congress for denying climate change and refusing to sign the UN Maritime Treaty, and chiding his critics for their attitude that working through international institutions or respecting international law is a sign of weakness. Veteran British diplomat and senior intelligence official Alistair Crook, the director and founder of Conflict Forum based in Beirut, who was the advisor on Middle East issues to Javier Solana, the EU foreign policy chief, joins us to discuss how Obama managed to navigate around the contradictions that the American public is fed up with intervention but likes being the world's leading superpower. Then we'll continue our examination of Obama's new foreign policy vision with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, whose latest book is Kindred's Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We will discuss Alistair Crook's contention that Obama's foreign policy has been hamstrung from the outset by the president's notion of emulating Abe Lincoln's team of rivals, which has led to the sabotage of Obama's foreign policy on the inside by neocons like Victoria Nuland and hawks like Hillary Clinton, leaving Obama to work in secret with Vladimir Putin and Iran's new leader so that the hawks and coal warriors who dominate our foreign policy establishment and the press don't jump on him. We'll also examine the contradiction that while Senator John McCain and the conservative opposition see negotiation as weakness and bombing as strength, the American people are largely on Obama's side, even if they don't support him. And joining us now is Alistair Crook, who is the director and founder of Conflicts Forum based in Beirut. He was a formerly advisor on Middle East issues to Javier Solana, the EU foreign policy chief. He was also a staff member of Senator George Mitchell's fact-finding committee that inquired into the causes of the Intifada, and he was an advisor to the International Quartet. And he facilitated various ceasefires in the occupied territories and the withdrawal of occupying forces on two occasions. Alistair Crook has had 20 years' experience working with Islamist movements and has extensive experience working with movements such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and other Islamist movements in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Middle East. He is the member of the UN's Alliance of Civilizations Global Experts and is the author of Resistance, the Essence of the Islamist Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alistair Crook.
Thank you very much indeed. Pleasure to be with you.
And what did you make of President Obama's speech at West Point in terms of what was being advertised as a new strategic vision?
Well, I thought it was quite interesting because a little while ago, President Obama did an interview, a long interview, in The New Yorker with David Rennick. And in that, I think it was not Obama himself, but one of these, it was the deputy for National Security Council representative, was speaking about saying that the main objective, the main policy objective for the president was to try and induce a small shift in perceptions in Washington. The aim was to try and move people away from what he described as a stale narrative. And what were those stale narratives? And I think those stale narratives that were being, which were being pointed at, were particularly the myths from the Cold War that America succeeded by staring down its enemies, and that it was a matter of demanding and getting, and not of showing weakness and of conceding. And I think the other part of the interview, which was very significant and which was very clear, was Obama trying to say in that interview and again in this speech at West Point that also the world is changing and has changed and has changed very dramatically and that far from him having, as I recall him putting it, that he had a joystick that he could control events and he could push it here or push it there, it was more a case of trying to find the current and trying to follow the current. Even if you don't quite know where the current goes, you have to try and follow it and try and push it in a direction which would be finally beneficial to U.S. interests and U.S. Objectives. And I think this is where we see this huge tension that's emerged, both within America and within Europe. He deliberately, at the outset of his administration, decided to opt what he called a team of rivals. In short, he took into his administration people, certainly in the foreign policy field, who were ideologically opposed to that type of thinking, who were, some of them, and still are, old Cold Warriors, who still have, if you like, follow the myth of the Cold War and America's victory in that war, and others who had a strong feelings about Iran and about Syria and other aspects of it, and tried to keep, if you like, the balance between these two. I think in the last few months we've seen very much that this policy of having people inside, and certainly there are many outside interests who are pushing in very different directions, has put the president on the back foot, on the defensive in foreign policy terms, particularly in the Middle East, being criticized for not being, if you like, assertive and aggressive enough in Syria, the same in Iran, the same in other areas, but of course, particularly in the case of Ukraine. So I think that very much the speech was trying to do this shift again of trying to say to people that you have to understand that the solution to the problems is not simply that of military intervention. That military intervention, particularly in the history that we've seen of Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places, has not been very successful. So I think he's trying to sort of make the case that actually you can be tough by refusing to intervene just as much by being assertive and aggressive and military posturing. And I think that what has been quite striking about this whole process also is the sense in which he is trying to keep, I think, a certain amount of space in order to avoid ending up by having to begin another war. That has been the other objective of the president from the beginning, how to avoid being pulled into a conflict either in the Middle East or, and certainly against Russia. So how to try quietly and carefully to do this. One of the ways he did it, which so incensed some of his administration, I think, in this time, one of the ways he did it was by having a quiet and not very much disclosed relationship with President Putin. This enabled him to resolve the crisis where he was nearly cornered into a war on Syria, enabled him to move towards negotiations with Iran, and had hoped that there would be further benefits in the Middle East. All of that was upset when parts of his own administration and others pushed him into a corner again in Ukraine against Russia. Possibly very much in the hope that that would actually undermine that relationship with Putin, which they disliked so much and believed was such a sign of growing American weakness. So where does all this take us? Well, I think, first of all, that perhaps the speech was not frank enough. He balanced this talk about military not being the answer to everything, but he balanced it by talking about American leadership, and that American leadership will preserve American exceptionalism. He referred to explicitly America as the indispensable state. And quite clearly, this is an attempt to sort of go back into the American mythology, to reinforce the American mythology, and indeed its longer heritage, going back to the sort of Pilgrim Fathers. But this is precisely the point, is that actually, whether we look at Europe or whether we look at the United States, this ability of leadership is increasingly being questioned, and people are rejecting the elites as a whole, not just the American president, not just Obama, but European elites, elites in the Middle East. There is a strong sense of, if you like, anti-system sentiment that is present. And that anti-system feeling is not just directed against the system itself that they're in. It's also paradoxically seen in terms of an anti-system against the global system. There's a strong dislike for the global system that emerged at the end of the Second World War and the global financial system that emerged at the end of the Second World War, which has given the United States such a particular privileged position and the ability to impose penalties on other states unilaterally. So I think that we're seeing, so to argue and say, well, the leadership is unchanged and nothing is going to change, it's really on a par with European leaders trying to say the same thing in Brussels after the drubbing they got at the local elections. It's quite clear that things are changing and that the leadership will have to change and adapt also. So I would say that in one sense, the president tried to make the case against the interventionists to argue for more assertiveness, more aggressiveness, in spite of the fact that public opinion is, in fact, in America and in Europe, is moving very much in the other direction, against that sort of assertive interventionism. But we are also not really seeing any attempt, either in Europe or in America, really to address the questions of why the elites are seen now to be so weak, and why they are, if you like, in many cases, certainly in the European case, so dysfunctional and so incapable of thinking strategically. And I think that what's happened in Ukraine is a very clear indication of how Europe is quite incapable of either thinking or acting strategically in the case of the European, in the case of the Ukraine crisis. So that's really the sort of sense that I think he's trying to do something, but perhaps it's sort of too much of a reach to try and really bring about a strong tug on the rudder and change the whole ship of state in a different direction. But there is a danger at these times, these sort of in points of political inflection, that if you don't speak plainly, if you don't say what you mean to say absolutely firmly and clearly and not in a very balanced way, then people don't get it and it becomes sunk and it is lost. And I fear that might be the consequence of the speech. But I do understand what he was trying to do.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Alistair Crook. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation on Obama's new foreign policy vision with Alistair Crook, who is the director and founder of Conflicts Forum based in Beirut, and he was formerly advisor on Middle East issues to Avia Salana, the EU foreign policy chief. And when you talk about how we won the Cold War and triumphalism and dancing in the end zone, as we say here in terms of American football, clearly you can't have it both ways. The foreign policy establishment in this country was taken by surprise when the Berlin Wall came down, and yet they're claiming somehow that they engineered this victory. And furthermore, there was a very narrow window in which a liberal democracy could have taken root in Russia, and we didn't give them any help. So I don't understand the triumphalism at the same time. You know, if you spend trillions on winning the Cold War, why couldn't you spend a few billions on securing the victory?
I think it actually is even more dangerous than what you have just described, because I returned recently from visiting Moscow and talking widely with the Russians. And although America has the sense that it successfully stared down Khrushchev and in the Cuban Missile Crisis, etc., and that this was the sort of pattern of the Cold War and the success, you don't find that in Russia. They believe that actually they were not defeated. They were not a defeated people in the Cold War, that there was an understanding that was reached between their leadership and the United States, and that this should have resulted in Russia becoming, if you like, a partner in a new order, and accepted and granted the esteem of having reached a settlement in the Cold War. So, in other words, unlike what happened in the Second World War, where the Japanese people really were psychologically defeated and felt a defeated people, you don't have that in Russia. On the contrary, many of them feel betrayed, and if anything, feel the sort of indignation that was felt in Germans against the Versailles Treaty that was imposed after the First World War, that the West treats them as if they're a defeated people, and it treats them with a lack of esteem is a consequence. But really, they don't feel that way. And I think that the fact that we don't recognize that, that we don't try and, understand the context when we think about what we're doing in foreign policy, means that we're apt to make direct mistakes in it. We need the idea of the myth can blind you to the fact that there's a very different factors out there and very different views about it held in Russia, as an example.
So, Alistair Crook, tell me about you were mentioning a back-channel relationship that President Obama has with President Putin that has been very much against the wishes of some of the leftovers. And there are some neoconservatives, needless to say. One of the people that exacerbated problems in Ukraine at the State Department is a leftover from the previous regime. And as you pointed out about the EU, it was, after all, the EU's zero-sum situation that they've imposed on Ukraine. You have to be with us, and you can't, in other words, you're either with us or with the Russians, but there's no middle ground. That provoked this crisis. But tell me about what you know about the relationship between Putin and Obama, which we've all been told has been frosty from the beginning.
I think that Obama repeated, and he repeated only a few months ago, that, he had three main policy aims, in foreign policy aims, one of which, of course, was the Israeli-Palestinian issue. The second one was Iran, and the third one was the reset. I think in many ways, as you point out, the fact that he brought in people who had a very different view, Hillary Clinton and Victoria Nuland and others, into the State Department, who had a completely opposed view of this, has indeed undermined the whole concept of the reset with Russia. Certainly for the Russians, there's a sense that actually the reset has brought absolutely no benefits at all. That is, in all of the areas that you look at it, it has been adverse for Russia. But I think that what has happened during this period is that Obama has tried quietly to bypass, if you like, the formal workings of the administration, the State Department, and the wider institutional element of the government, with its inherited hostility, if you like, towards Russia and its heritage of the Cold War, by opening out directly with Putin. And one of Putin's aides said a little while ago that Putin actually likes him. They're very different people, but admires him. Putin's hard-headed, and he's a tough person, but he does respect him and is able to do business with him. And I think that was crucial in that area. What has really complicated, I think, the American foreign policy during this time is that Obama felt inhibited from saying this publicly. He could not say, even within his own administration, that he was relying so heavily on Putin in the Middle East because of the adverse reaction that would come, not just from the Republicans, not just from the opposition, not just from other interests in Washington, but from within his own administration who've been working to stop it. Particularly those opposed to his policy on Iran and viscerally on Syria. So I think that has been very difficult. How do you run a foreign policy when you have various levels? That the president has a foreign policy which is kept within a tight and very narrow circle of advisers, and a foreign policy which is quite different, which is being pursued elsewhere. I saw that once happening in the British government with David Owen, and it becomes very complicated. You know, papers have to go to this department, to this assistant secretary, but admit this one, not see, be seen by someone else. In the end, the whole system becomes, if you like, dysfunctional and works against itself. And I think there has been an element of that which goes back and really goes back to the whole decision to have a team of rivals as the basis of his administration. I mean, it's too early to say, but I wonder what in his memoirs he'll say about the decision to take in so many people who were ideologically opposed to his thinking into his administration, and whether it was a good idea with hindsight. But yes, there is, and indeed the same thing is now happening with Ukraine. We see in the sense of a possibility now of de-escalation of the Ukrainian crisis. Putin has made a number of important gestures and statements in response to this private channel. He's withdrawn the troops from the border area. Indeed, he's even gone further and confined some to barracks who are in Russia. He has said he respects the choice of the people in terms of the 25th of May election. And Lavrov has said very clearly that they will deal and engage with a new president, the elected president. So that is very clearly intended to be one side of if you like, the possibility for a de-escalation. And I think the question is the president capable of taking that forward against the increasing pressures that you see being placed on him from various quarters, including the mainstream press, but from interest groups and from within his party and within his own State Department, who are pushing more for escalation and ultimately for some form of sanctions against Russia in consequence for what they say is Putin's destabilization and attacks on the process. So I think that we see now both exactly what the speech was trying to address in terms of Ukraine. Here you have a president who is trying to pull it back from escalation and from a conflict which has already done enormous damage to the United States, because it's pushed Russia and China together in a shift that might herald a real change to the geopolitical order, actualizing something that has been talked about but has not happened, but is now actually taking some form of shape. So I think he is now trying to pull it back through that private channel. But whether it's going to be possible, it's difficult, dynamic. The position of the Democrats is not easy coming up to the midterms. There is a sense that the foreign policy of the president is his Achilles heel in terms of the elections coming up. And there are very strong voices in the media and elsewhere calling for a more assertive action against Putin and against those that are seen to be dissidents in Ukraine. So it's very uncertain how it will come out. But I'm sure that is the context and the background by which we should try and understand what he was saying at West Point.
And again, I'm speaking with Alistair Crook, who's the director and founder of Conflicts Forum based in Beirut, and he was formerly advisor on Middle East issues to Javier Solana, the EU foreign policy chief, and he is the author of Resistance, the Essence of the Islamist Revolution. And of course, the one thing that Obama has on his side, for what it's worth, is the American people.
Yes, he does.
The foreign policy elites and the press may be hawkish, but the American people are tired of war and fruitless intervention. But I've talked to a number of historians of late, and analogies have been brought up about the build-up to the outbreak of World War One. You know, the so-called Guns of August, or the March of Folly, as Barbara Tuchman referred to it. And is there anything to that possibility that history could repeat itself in terms of NATO is all but moribund, and yet maybe there'll be a push to revive it? The alliances with Japan, if they have a spat over these piles of rocks in the South China Sea, could that drag us in? Are we, because in your recent essay, Cold War Mythologies and Iranian Negotiations, you talked about the possibility that this is going to be a very difficult and perhaps explosive summer.
I think it's actually very crucial. And I do think that your analogy that is this 1914 is actually quite apt in the sense that no one is wanting conflict. I don't think President Obama wants any escalation. In fact, I think he's doing whatever he can to try and pull it back from it. Yes, there are hotheads in Europe and America who would like it, but we always have those about. And I would say that both China and Russia feel that they're treading on eggshells in trying to avoid almost doing anything to avoid being brought into a new conflict. Prime Minister Medvedev, who, as you know, is very far from an enemy of the United States, in fact, is probably one of the strongest Atlanticists in Russia, was complaining bitterly how he feels that Russia is being pushed into a Cold War which is needless and which nobody wants and which is ultimately futile, as he said. And I think there's a similar feeling in China. So they're not looking for conflict with the United States. But I think the great danger here is not from NATO, not from tanks and not from bombs, but from the other neutron weapon which the United States hold, which is the weapon of what is called the scarlet letter, the ability to issue a letter which effectively freezes a bank or a whole series of banks out of the global financial system, which prevents them from doing business with Europe or anywhere else in the world in foreign currency matters, and which can effectively collapse the financial structure of a foreign state. And this is what I think, is being threatened against Russia. It's, you know, not the old-fashioned trade wars of, you know, well, we won't buy your this and you won't buy our that. And it's not going to be to try and sort of penalize the gas exports of Russia. It's not practical to do that. What we're talking about is an attempt to do what has been done to Iran, which is to freeze it's called by the Treasury officials who wrote the book about the Treasury's war, the America's quiet neutron bomb. And it is that dangerous. What is quite different is that, you know, we're now dealing not with a small insignificant state, but a major state of Russia and one of the biggest energy producers in the world. And they have the ability to hit back. And they hit back and hit back in many ways. Not only in form of moving off away from the dollar and working with China, as they have begun to do in many, many ways, to move towards an alternative financial system which is not dominated by the United States, and which could cause, that in itself could cause the United States a huge difficulty in financing many things, most of its foreign policy, if there is this move. And many central banks, more than 40 central banks, have already started using the Chinese yuan as its foreign currency reserve. And treating it as a convertible reserve, even though it's not formally convertible. So there's been a huge move in that direction. But the other thing is that if you exclude Russia from our financial system, if you like, why is it then assumed that Russia will not respond? It's one of the most sophisticated states in times of cyber warfare. As one expert put it to me, Russia not only is extremely good, brilliant in the cyber field, but they know how to use it strategically, which the West has not yet learned, he said to me. And that is the great danger. Do we imagine that our Swift banking system, our creaking old financial software systems which support European banks and American banks, are inviolable to Russia and China? If we exclude them from our system, that there's not any reason for them to retaliate in kind against it. And how are we going to do this at a time when certainly Europe is walking along the precipice of economic weakness and a further move into recession? To engage in this sort of warfare seems to me could lead to all sorts of consequences, which would really be a new epoch, an epoch rather as you described, not the same as 1914, which was very much a sort of military type of conflict, but a new form of conflict. And I think that's what is a great danger, that we can be pushed into that, because America doesn't want to put boots on the ground. They don't want to fire missiles at Russia. The obvious answer is let's pull the plug on their financial system. And there are many people those who've been involved in the formulation of this extraordinary weapon, new weapon in the hands of the president, who are urging him to use it. But if he does, I can't imagine what the consequences will be where I am in Italy or in France or in Spain or in the United States, who will survive this type of conflict.
Well, Alistair Crook, I'd like to talk to you more, but we've run out of time, and I hope we can have another conversation, and I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on your program. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Alistair Crook, who's the director and founder of Conflicts Forum based in Beirut. He was formerly advisor on Middle East issues to Javier Solana, the EU foreign policy chief, and he's also was a staff member of Senator George Mitchell's fact-finding committee that inquired into the causes of the Intifada and was advisor to the International Quartet. He facilitated various ceasefires in the occupied territories and the withdrawal of occupying forces on two occasions. And Alistair Crook has had 20 years' experience working with Islamist movements and has extensive experience working with movements such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and other Islamist movements in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Middle East. And he's a member of the UN's Alliance of Civilizations Global Experts and is the author of Resistance, the Essence of the Islamist Revolution. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with further analysis of President Obama's new foreign policy vision.
War is not the answer.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And what was your impression of President Obama's new foreign policy vision outlined at West Point?
Well, I thought Alistair Crook's appraisal was quite eloquent and elegant. I think Obama was trying to do very much what Mr. Crook outlined, to dispel the old myths of the Cold War. He has been, as Crook put it, on his back foot, somewhat defensive about that. I think he is dealing with a world that's changing very rapidly, that is indeed anti-system. He's dealing with a Russian mentality of revisionism, of what they thought was a somewhat brutal and unfair, just Cold War peace. I agree with him that Obama does have this relationship with Putin, as he does with some other leaders in the world, that is somewhat furtive and covert, certainly hidden from much of Washington or the mainstream media. I would disagree with one characterization, which was that this all comes from the team of rivals. It's true that Obama talked a lot about that book and had read it when he began to form his government. But what in fact happened was really quite different. President Lincoln brought together the most eminent figures of the Republican Party, some of the old Whigs, people like William Seward, who were exceptional figures in American politics, very much Lincoln's intellectual equals, and in some respects, certainly his cultural and class betters. That was not the case with Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton could not be confused as his intellectual better. And many of the culprits that Mr. Crook is identifying here, the neocons who came into the Obama administration, were allowed to either continue in positions of authority that they'd enjoyed under the Bush regime, or were given new responsibilities, what could hardly be in the same category. You know, my characterization of the speech, Ian, is that there is not very much here that was new if one has been following what the president has been saying or trying to say in press conferences or in other speeches. I hate to be pedestrian and provincial here after Alistair Crook's elegant presentation, but as we used to say in New Mexico, I think the president in this case is all hat and no cattle, meaning that there's not very much substance beyond the rather noble expression that he is quite good at. Yes, of course, he's had a relationship with Putin. We've seen the benefits of that, as Alistair Crook pointed out, in Syria, to some extent in Iran already, and certainly in the restraint of Moscow in the Crimea. That's been quite beneficial for him. But we have also seen the cost, to the price of having within your own ranks this built-in opposition, and that's been manifest, of course, in the ascendancy of the Pentagon and the military in Afghanistan, the continuing impotence in dealing with the Egyptian tyranny, the veritable military takeover and coup there, and obviously also in the Ukraine, where Obama was a victim very much, I think, of a covert action and a bureaucratic rebellion within his own party, within his own ranks. This is all, you and I have talked about this before, this is all the result of having assembled to begin with a very weak and vulnerable White House staff. If you're going to oppose a rival like Hillary Clinton, whose politics are all too clear in the State Department, if you're going to keep Bob Gates in the Pentagon and try to do something about the dominance of American foreign policy by the military and by this huge glandular intelligence establishment that built up in the Bush years, if you're going to do all that, you have to have more than Jim Jones or Tom Donilon or McDonough or Rhodes or the sort of second and third rate people that he assembled around him. Some of those, Samantha Power and Susan Rice, for that matter, even opposed him in the Libyan bombing, which is, as we all know, has turned into a rather sour and tragic sequel. On the other hand, this did not, and I think this is one of the ironies of the Obama administration, this did not necessarily lead to some kind of ascendance of diplomacy or of a new foreign policy. I call Hillary Clinton frequent flyer because I think she did not much more than flit around the world. She did nothing to reform that institution or to repair its loss of prestige and power to the Pentagon and to the CIA and to the intelligence community in general. It's an irony. I think John Kerry is doing, ironically, another subject, doing more vis-a-vis the Pentagon and Chuck Hagel than she ever did with Bob Gates. The speech, I thought, was pedestrian to a large extent. One thing struck me. One of the decided ovations he got was when he said to this graduating class of Army second lieutenants, you're going to be the first class in a very long time that'll be graduating out into a world where you're not going to be automatically sent to a theater of war. And they were quite happy to hear that. The unspoken side of that is that this will quite possibly be the single most powerful graduating class of West Point in the history of the Academy. And by that I mean they will inherit a system in which the military tail wags the dog from the Middle East through Africa into Central Asia. They will dominate the special operations that really shapes so much of American foreign policy. They will make the policy choices that will determine how the drones are used. This is going to be an extraordinarily powerful generation of young officers. We can only hope to God they are better educated than their predecessors. But this was, I think, Obama at his best and at the same time at his worst. He was not very candid, after all, about what the real choices are, what the real crisis is in the Ukraine. Didn't talk at all about the history, the tragic history that Alistair Crook did refer to, how much America is responsible for this attitude, both in the Kremlin and the facts on the ground. So, and it has been, as you have so well pointed out in past programs, very misrepresented, if not totally distorted, by the American media.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. So how does Obama deal with this contradiction that the American public is fed up with intervention, but they like being the world's leading superpower, and he's up against a foreign policy establishment and press that are very hawkish and full of cold warriors, and he's got constant sniping from Senator John McCain, who I think he pointed out in his talk at West Point, Obama suggested, you know, that they see negotiation as weakness, and I would add to that they see bombing as strength. But the irony, of course, is throughout all of the, given that the deck is stacked against Obama, who's apparently quietly trying to stop a catastrophe from happening, the American people are largely on his side, even those that don't support him.
Well, I disagree with Alistair Crook that there is quite so much pressure on this president. I know there seems to be inside the Beltway in particular, and the Democrats are facing a midterm election. But we know from all of the polls that foreign policy is well down the list of crucial issues in that election. The president's perceived weakness vis-a-vis the Russians or anybody else in the world is not a compelling issue for people who are still suffering a sluggish, if not failed, recovery, for people who are still very, very uncertain about the future and the future of their children. Domestic issues are going to be by far, I think, the most decisive in the 2016 election and in the 2014 before. So that I don't think the Democrats face a foreign policy referendum on Obama's policies anytime soon. And I think the pressure is as much as you let it be. The Beltway media and all the rest, I think, have been doing what they always do. It's quite predictable. And the president has been doing, let's face it, what he always does, which is to deflect this with a certain aplomb. He deals very well in this world of rhetoric and of as the sometime constitutional law professor lecturing his audience. He has kept the lid on the worst of this. I think he needs much better and stronger people immediately around him. You know, I watched very, very intimately, Ian, a president named Richard Nixon oppose almost all of his own government, and certainly the old democratically dominated bureaucracy, and he did it by having someone as ruthless and as brilliant and as power hungry as Henry Kissinger at his side. It's not impossible for presidents to run in effect a kind of de facto dictatorship in foreign policy if they're skillful enough, if they're political enough, and if they understand how policy is made. But the most distressing thing about Obama, and I think it's been there from the very beginning, is that there's a kind of overweening arrogance and I think at the same time a haunting ignorance in the man about how policy is actually made. What happened in the Ukraine was a matter of all of these officially funded, government-funded programs, some covert, some overt, really off the reservation, and not functioning within what the White House understood to be presidential policy, but doing the bidding of Victoria Nuland and the neocons who are left within the government. Until January 20th, 2017, assuming that Hillary Clinton is the heiress here, Barack Obama will be the chief executive of the United States. He will have enormous power if he understands finally, at long last, where the levers of power are and how to use them. And if he continues to make his case steadfastly and continues to resist I think what is for the most part a kind of fading pressure on Iran, if he continues to get the kind of cooperation that he has gotten so far from Tehran, from Rouhani, and from Putin in Moscow, then I think he's going to make it. I agree with Alistair Crook that we're living in a very precarious age of financial interdependence, that the United States is very vulnerable to a cyber attack. The financial system we know can come crashing down around us, but it's almost akin to a system you know very well from your study called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction, which we had in the nuclear age with the nuclear standoff with the Soviet Union. No power can institute this exchange, can begin this kind of warfare without suffering, really in the end, unacceptable damage themselves. So this was a myth, incidentally, of pre-World War One Europe, that the economies of the old Europe, and certainly the British and the Germans and the French and even the Russians to some extent, were so intertwined that they could not afford to go to war. Now, that certainly was not true in 1914, but it is much more true in 2014, and that very interdependence, I think, is maybe our very best hope.
Well, you mentioned how Nixon and Kissinger were able to control and do an end run around the bureaucracy. When you mentioned that, I thought, and you could add to that, and Vice President Cheney also was a great exemplar of
that. Oh, absolutely. And you know, I mean, Alistair Crook was saying, well, when you have papers going here and not going there, and you have, there's lots of examples of this, of course, in Whitehall and Downing Street. You do have dysfunctional government. government and dysfunctional systems. My goodness, the Nixon administration was broadly dysfunctional in terms of the bureaucracy and suffered its own Snowden cases, its own defections, and the Pentagon Papers crisis, and ultimately the crisis of extra constitutional acts that brought it down. But for the most part, Kissinger and Nixon function as a kind of diarchy, as a kind of co-ruled regime, the Hindenburg and Ludendorff, I used to call them, of American politics, and they simply did what they thought they ought to do and needed to do, and thus the opening to China, thus the SALT Treaty that was done against much of the advice of the Pentagon. They emasculated the Department of State. They simply ignored the CIA, thus the atrocities that took place in much of the world, in Chile and in Bangladesh, and the atrocity of the continuing war in Vietnam. But no one at the end of the process was ever confused about who was actually calling the shots and who was actually running foreign policy. I think Barack Obama will look back in his memoirs with some regret about not only those appointments, I hope, but also about how much he did not understand, how much he did not come to grips with the actual functioning of the U.S. government.
But it seems to me that what I was struck by what Alistair Crook was saying is that we are at a very important state of flux here, that it could go one way or the other, that even what's happened so far in Ukraine may well have driven Putin and China together. I know they've been negotiating that gas deal for decades. But the idea that you could push Russia and China together, that they could form an alternative financial system, and that there's still pressure on Obama to use the so-called financial neutron bomb, the Scarlet Letter, which apparently is, and I believe this to be the case, America's most powerful weapon. It's the power of our control over the international financial system. You pull that trigger once, it's all over. So I think we're at a critical stage, aren't we?
Well, I think we are, Ian. But as I said earlier, the assured destruction is mutual. I think no one mistakes that at this point. I do think there will be pressure on all sides. But I think we're going to get he's going to get some help from the Iranians, and I think that there obviously are limiting factors here in Moscow. Putin wants and will deal with the Crimea. I think what he wants out of the Ukraine is a faith-saving device that will not cost him too dearly, but will keep his new and growing power at home more or less intact. I think he does want to deal with this new government. He does undoubtedly see it as an American creature, but what else is new? I mean, he's dealing all along his old border there with American creatures of one kind or another. You know, the history of Russian restraint in crises like this, even crises that have a more dire implication for power in Moscow, the history of Russian restraint is sort of encouraging. Gorbachev did not, we should remember, call in the troops when the Baltic states were going. He did not call in the troops when it was clear that Poland and East Germany were teetering. And it was that decision to cede the political space to the West or to the reformist elements in the old satellites that saved us from a kind of terminal crisis in the Cold War. It's not often talked about, but it was an act of true statesmanship, and it came from the Kremlin. And there certainly were elements in the Russian military, as there in the Soviet military then, as there are in the Russian military now, that wanted a confrontation of one sort or to one degree or another with the West. But I think that our best bet here, honestly, is that Obama continue what is his specialty as a rather phlegmatic and poised political creature, if not as an administrator of a government, but as a political creature, and that he can keep the lid on. At least we can hope for that.
So you don't see the idea of a sort of axis organized against the United States, China, Iran, and Russia?
Oh, I absolutely I do, but I don't think that's a result of anything that's happened in the last 20 minutes or the last 20 months. That's been forming for a very, very long time. The unipolar world that emerged with the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the old Soviet Union, the seeming preeminence of American power, which then went on to strut its stuff and to suffer its comeuppance so ignominiously in Iraq and Afghanistan, all of that is a long-term development. Of course, the Russians and the Chinese will collaborate and will learn to come together. But there are restraining factors on all sides. The Chinese are still very much in search of a regional power role, not a global one. The Chinese have no stake in some kind of global confrontation in business, financial terms, least of all, certainly not in military terms. I think there are real restraints operating in Beijing. The Russians, God knows, have got their economic problems, and yes, they're a gifted people, and yes, they could hurt us a great deal in any kind of economic or cyber confrontation. But I think their stake in peace and their stake in realizing the traditional role of Eastern Europe and the borderlands as a buffer, as an area of their influence and domination, will appease a lot of that. I mean, I just think that there are some positive developments here, and in a sense, the most positive is the one that you pointed out, which is that Obama seems to have nobody or very few people inside the Beltway on his side, and a decided majority outside who are in his corner. And he doesn't even need their active support. He needs their neutrality. He needs them to be absent from the debate. And I think they will be very largely. They will absent themselves in 2014 in November and again in 2016 because they're going to be preoccupied, as I think they probably should be, with the tragedy of their own domestic economic mess.
And meanwhile, of course, the anti-system uprising and popular rejection of elites in Europe and the Middle East and here in the United States will continue. And that's
will continue, and that's another very, very hopeful development. I think that's happening faster and more widely than we might have suspected some time ago. God knows Obama has not really contributed very much to that. He is, as Alistair Crook said, sort of trying to navigate the current here, the rapids of whitewater, which is what he's riding. But that's happening everywhere, and it's bound to be reflected sooner or later in the electoral politics of the Europeans. And I do think this fascist craze is a passing thing in Europe, the turn right, and I do think that it's going to be reflected sooner or later in Russian politics as well. If I had to pick, this may sound crazy, if I had to pick who would be the most enduring political symbols of this era 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, I would say that Pussy Riot will be every bit as important as Vladimir Putin.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, and his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.